Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a group of scientists is hurrying to document ancient ruins on the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. The sites along Puerto Rico's coast date back a few thousand years. The scientists are working as fast as they can before rising sea levels destroy a large part of the island's history. Scientists hope to use the three-dimensional images they have taken to help identify which sites are most at risk to natural disasters and other dangers. Falco Kuster is director of the Cultural Heritage Engineering Initiative at the University of California, San Diego. He said, "A big part of what we're working on is to make the invisible visible and make sure it stays in our memory." The university, known as UCSD, is involved in the research project. Also involved are its Scripps Institution of Oceanography and Para la Naturaleza, an environmental group based in Puerto Rico. The work started in August 2017. Scientists first explored a large stretch of land along Puerto Rico's north coast. That area includes a ceremonial center used by the Taino Indians about 2,000 years ago, said Isabel Rivera Collazo. Rivera is an environmental archaeologist at UCSD and directing the project. She said the scientists found what appears to be a large settlement just east of the ceremonial site. It was discovered with help from drone aircraft and other technology, including 3D images. She added that scientists were also able to map out the shape of the ceremonial site. The Taínos once lived on many islands in the Caribbean Sea. But after the arrival of Christopher Columbus and other Europeans, the indigenous people were nearly all killed. Rivera said, "Up to today, there is still a lot we don't know about indigenous culture along our coasts. It's not in our history books. We want to recover that information before it disappears." Puerto Rico's Department of Natural Resources has said the sea level around the island is rising by more than 3 millimeters every year. However, climate change has more immediate effects. These include the destruction of the island's coastline and natural habitats. Some scientists say that warmer temperatures in the Caribbean increase the number and strength of storms. Puerto Rico faces the possibility of storms every year for 6 months during the Atlantic hurricane season. Scientists noted that large amounts of water caused by Hurricane Maria washed away part of the area they are studying. Eric Lowe is an engineer with UCSD's Cultural Heritage Initiative. He flew to Puerto Rico in August 2017 to launch the project 1 month before Maria struck the island. Lowe was surprised at what he saw when he returned to the U.S. territory months later. he said. Pieces of land where I had stood and flown the drone didn't exist anymore. They were underwater. Scientists are now trying to find out how badly the hurricane and loss of land have affected the archaeological site they are studying. The scientists are using 3D models based on drone images to measure areas and explore other details.
Experts say a recent change in the color of the Mekong River from yellowish brown to sky blue could be a worrying sign. They say the change suggests a possible problem caused by dams that have been built along the Mekong. The river covers a distance of 4,300 kilometers. It begins high in the mountains of Tibet, flowing through China and five other countries: Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. The river eventually joins with the South China Sea. The Mekong usually has a yellowish-brown color that results from the sediment it normally carries. But recent reports say it has been running clear, taking on a bluish-green color like that of the sky. The water levels have also become unusually low, creating sandbanks that enable people to stand in the middle of the river. The low water levels clearly cause problems for fishermen and farmers. But experts in Thailand say the decrease in sediment represents a different threat, one that can result in a greater erosion of the sides and bottom of the river. Experts and people living along the river blame the changes on a large hydroelectric dam upriver in Laos. The Xayaburi Dam began operating in October. Critics say it is blocking much sediment from flowing down the river. About 70 million people depend on the Mekong River for water, food, jobs, agriculture, and transportation. Critics say several large dam projects along the Mekong are harming the river and its environment. Pravit Kantatuang is chief of the fishery office at Bengkong Long District in northeast Thailand. He told the Associated Press the Xayaburi Dam is responsible for the water becoming clear. Less sediment means less nutrition for plants and fish, possibly threatening the river's ecological balance, he added. With less sediment, the force of the water also strengthens, Chayarong Sitachau told the AP. Chayarong teaches at Maha Saramkom University and has studied changes in the Mekong's environment for more than 20 years. The current has less sediment, which unleashes energy onto the riverbanks downstream. This so-called hungry water will cause much more erosion to the banks, uprooting trees and damaging engineering structures in the river, Chayarong said. The dam's developers have denied responsibility for low water levels that critics have said were caused by equipment tests that began in March. In October, the Xayaburi Power Company Limited said the project had spent more than $640 million to lessen harmful effects on the environment. The company said this included the building of outlets for sediment to pass through and systems to permit the passage of fish. I'm Brian Lynn.
In the United States, about 25 million children are either overweight or obese. A new study explored how being overweight or obese might affect brain development in children. A report on the study appeared this month in JAMA Pediatrics, a publication of the American Medical Association. The writers suggested a link between body mass index, brain development, and executive functions such as working memory. An editorial published with the report called the study an important addition to growing evidence of a link between weight, brain structure, and mental function. It also warned against misinterpreting the findings. The study involved 3,190 U.S. boys and girls aged 9 and 10. Researchers had height and weight measurements and MRI scans of their brains. MRI is short for magnetic resonance imaging, a method used to take pictures of organs and tissues within the body. The children took computer-based tests of mental function, including memory, language, reasoning, and impulse control. Nearly 1,000 of the kids, almost one in three, were overweight or obese, similar to levels nationwide. Researchers found differences in the brain scan images of the heaviest children. They observed slightly less volume, the amount of space, in the brain behind the forehead. This area controls what are known as executive function tasks. Such tasks include things like planning, controlling impulses, and dealing with two or more activities at the same time. Compared with normal weight children, the differences were small, noted Scott Mackey, a neuroscientist at the University of Vermont. The heaviest children also had slightly worse results on the computer-based tests of executive function. But it is unknown whether any of the differences had much of an effect on children's behavior or performance in school. Those are the opinions of Mackey and Jennifer Laurent, a University of Vermont researcher. Laurent was the lead author of the report on the study. It is also unclear how the differences relate to weight. Mackey said other factors not measured in the study, including physical activity and good nutrition, are likely important. Research in adults has linked obesity with low-level inflammation throughout the body. The condition can damage blood vessels and may increase risks for heart disease and loss of mental ability. Some studies have also found less brain volume in obese adults. Researchers suspect that the decreased brain volume could be from inflammation. The new study raises the possibility that inflammatory changes affecting weight, brain structure, and brain function might begin in childhood. Eliana Perrin is a doctor and specialist of children's health at Duke University in North Carolina. She co-wrote the editorial published in JAMA Pediatrics. She says that people should be careful about how they interpret the study. We don't know which direction these relationships go, nor do they suggest that people with obesity are not as smart as people at a healthy weight, she said. The latest research confirms results of earlier studies in children and adults, but it leaves many questions unanswered, said Marcy Gluck. Gluck is with the U.S. National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. She was not part of the research and warned people against making a link between executive function and intelligence. Natasha Schwey is an obesity researcher with the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. She called the study impressive, but noted that many factors influence people's diets and obesity. We know from a lot of really good research that obesity is not as much in an individual's control as we think it is. People talk about willpower. That's a very small part of the equation, she said. There are much bigger contributors to our weight, and a lot of it is genetic. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Surrender finally came for General Robert E. Lee and the Confederacy he had served as a great soldier. It was mostly his military skill and intelligence that kept the South in the field so long. But even his extraordinary skill could not save the South from the industrial power of the North and its mighty armies, armies that were well-fed and well-equipped. Stuart Spencer and Leo Scully continue the story of the American Civil War.
The last chapter of the bitter four-year struggle came in April 1865. General Grant had pushed Lee's army away from Richmond and nearby Petersburg, Virginia. His Union forces had kept after the Confederates for almost a week. Lee fled westward across Virginia. His tired, hungry soldiers tried to turn south, to reach safety in the Carolinas. But always, the Union Army blocked the way. Finally, on Saturday, April 8th, Lee's army found it could flee no farther. A Union force at Appomattox Station blocked any further movement to the west. Early the next morning, Lee tried to break through the ring of Union soldiers that surrounded his army, but he failed. Nothing was left, nothing but surrender.
Lee sent a note to General Grant, asking to meet with him to discuss surrender terms. A few hours later, General Grant rode into the crossroads village of Appomattox Courthouse. General Lee was waiting for him at the home of a man named Wilmer McLean. Lee rose as Grant walked into the house. Grant did not look like a great military leader, the chief of all Union armies. He was dressed simply. His clothes were the same as those worn by the lowest soldiers in his army. His boots and pants were covered with mud. His blue coat was dirty and wrinkled. But on its shoulders were the three gold stars of the Union's highest general.
Lee was dressed in his finest clothing. He wore a beautiful gray coat with a red sash tied around it. At his side, he carried an ivory and silver sword. The two generals greeted each other and shook hands. Grant said, "I met you once before, General Lee, while we were serving in Mexico. I have always remembered your appearance. I think I would have recognized you anywhere." Lee said, "Yes, I know I met you then, and I have often tried to remember how you looked, but I have never been able to remember a single feature."
Grant continued to talk of their service in the Mexican War. He said later that he did so because he was finding it difficult to bring up the question of surrender. Lee took part in the light talk for several minutes. Finally, he said, "I suppose, General Grant, that the purpose of our meeting is fully understood. I asked to see you to learn upon what terms you would receive the surrender of my army." Grant answered, "The terms I propose are those I offered in my earlier note to you. That is, the officers and men surrendered will not take up arms again, and all your weapons and supplies will become captured property."
Lee said those were the conditions he had expected. He asked Grant to put the terms in writing so he could sign them. "Very well," said Grant. "I will write them out." It took him several minutes to write the surrender agreement. Only once did he look up. He had just written the sentence, "The arms, artillery, and public property will be given over to the Union Army." Grant stopped writing and looked over at the sword the old general wore. He decided there was no need to hurt Lee's pride by taking away his sword. So he added, "This will not include the sidearms of the officers, nor their horses, or other private property. Each officer and man shall be allowed to return to his home. He will not be disturbed by United States authorities as long as he honors this agreement and obeys the laws where he lives."
Grant gave the paper to Lee. Lee read it slowly. When he finished, Grant asked if the Confederate general wished to propose any changes. Lee was silent for a moment. "There is one thing," he said. "The cavalrymen and artillerymen in our army own their own horses. I would like to understand if these men will be allowed to keep their horses." "You will find," Grant said, "that the terms as written do not allow it. Only the officers are permitted to take their private property." "You are correct," said Lee. "I see the terms do not allow it. That is clear."
Until now, Lee's face had shown no emotion. But for a moment, his self-control weakened. Grant could see how badly Lee wanted this. "Well," said Grant, "I did not know that any private soldiers owned their horses. But I think that this will be the last battle of the war. I sincerely hope so. I think that the surrender of this army will be followed soon by that of all the others. I take it that most of your soldiers are small farmers and will need the horses to put in a crop that will carry themselves and their families through the next winter. I will not change the terms as they are written, but I will tell my officers to let all the men who claim to own a horse or mule take the animals home with them to work their little farms."
Lee was pleased with this. He told Grant, "This will have the best possible effect upon the men. It will be very gratifying and will do much to help our people." While waiting for the surrender papers to be copied, Grant presented Lee to the other Union officers in the room. Lee had known some of them before the war. After a few minutes, Lee turned to Grant. He told him that his army held about 1,000 Union soldiers as war prisoners. He said that for the past few days, he had no food but cracked corn to give them. He said he had nothing to give his own men to eat. Grant called in his supply officer and ordered him to feed the Confederate Army. He told him to send to Lee's army enough food for 25,000 men.
Finally, the surrender papers were ready. Grant and Lee signed them. Lee shook hands with Grant and walked out of the house. Lee got on his horse and rode slowly back to his army. As he entered Confederate lines, men began to cheer, but the cheering died when the soldiers saw the pain and sorrow in Lee's face. Tears filled the old man's eyes. He could not speak. Soldiers removed their hats and watched silently as Lee rode past. Many wept.
A crowd of soldiers waited at Lee's headquarters. They pushed close around him, trying to touch him, trying to shake his hand. Lee began to speak. "Boys, I have done the best I could for you. Go home now. And if you make as good citizens as you have soldiers, you will do well. I shall always be proud of you. Goodbye, and God bless you all." From the crowd came a loud cry. "Farewell, General Lee. I wish for your sake and mine that every damned Yankee on earth was sunk 10 miles in hell."
On the other side of the lines, Union soldiers began to celebrate. Artillerymen fired their guns to salute the victory over Lee. Grant heard the artillery booming and sent orders that it should stop. "The rebels are our countrymen again," he said. "We can best show our joy by refusing to celebrate their downfall."
General Grant left Appomattox Courthouse to return to his headquarters a few kilometers away. Suddenly, he stopped his horse. He had forgotten to tell President Lincoln or War Secretary Stanton that Lee had surrendered. He sat down at the side of the road and wrote a telegram to Secretary Stanton. News of the surrender reached Washington late on Sunday. Most citizens in the capital did not learn of it until early the next morning. Then cannons began to boom out over the city. Crowds rushed to the White House to cheer the president. They asked Lincoln to make a victory speech. Lincoln said he had not prepared a statement. He wished to wait until the next night. He asked the people to come back then, and he would have something to say.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.